Iran's parliament approves all but one of President Ebrahim Raisi's proposed cabinet ministers. Turkey says it started withdrawing its troops from Afghanistan, but can continue its mission to run the Kabul airport. And Pan American Health Organization says unequal distribution of COVID vaccines is the main weak point in efforts to fight the disease in the Americas. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. Iran's parliament has approved all but one of the 19 proposed ministers of President Ebrahim Raisi. Announcement came on the last day of a five-day vote of confidence process held in Iran's Majlis. Yusuf Jalali reports.
After 5 days of marathon debates in parliament over the credentials of President Raisi's cabinet choices, all but one of the 19 proposed ministers won the parliament's confidence. Parliament gave no confidence to Hossein Barghouti, the proposed education minister, with 76 votes in favor, 193 against, and 18 abstentions. In his address to parliament, President Raisi said his cabinet will start its work as soon as the following day. He says he will not waste an hour to solve the country's problems.
After the vote of confidence is over, we will kickstart our activities with the new cabinet as of tomorrow. Our country is grappling with serious issues, and we must not waste even an hour to address them. Issues such as the fight against the coronavirus and the need to speed up nationwide vaccination will be on top of our agenda.
The ministers of defense, foreign affairs, and intelligence were among the nominees with the highest votes. Lawmakers say this signals that parliament shares the same approach with the government over foreign policy and national security.
This is meaningful. It shows that parliament will support the plans of the new ministers. And as the president says, the new cabinet will work throughout the day to solve the problems of the country.
Ebrahim Raisi handed his proposed cabinet lineup to parliament 2 weeks ago, a week after he took the oath of office as Iran's new president. Legislators then started reviewing the credentials of the proposed ministers behind closed doors for a week, and in the open sessions for the past 5 days. With just one nominee dropping out of the list, it seems that the new government will not face serious friction with parliament in its job. Raisi now has 3 months to introduce a new name for education minister, and until then, a caretaker will be appointed to run the ministry. Yusuf Jalali from Iran's parliament.
Israel has threatened it may have to resort to launching military action against Iran to help the U.S. negotiate a new nuclear deal with Tehran. Regime's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, has accused Iran of seeking to build a nuclear weapon. He said a military action must be considered as a plan B to prevent Iran from accessing materials for a nuke. Israel's chief of staff had also made a similar threat. Developments come as the Vienna talks aimed at reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal appear to have stalled. Iran has time and again rejected any renegotiation of the accord. Moreover, Iranian officials have on many occasions stressed that Tehran does not want war, but will give a crushing response to any aggressors. Political commentator Frank Anspach says the U.S. has to publicly acknowledge Israel is the sole owner of nuclear weapons in the region.
The White House would have to recognize publicly that Israel also has nuclear weapons, and that if we're going to have an equitable settlement about this, everybody has to be involved. And I don't think anybody in the White House is even thinking about that at this stage of the game, or any stage in the last 20 years. And that is the biggest danger, where we think, because of the economic toll that we can exact on Iran, with the cooperation of the Europeans, that it's going to be enough to get what we want. And I personally, from the outside, don't see that. And I don't think it's going to work so well. And so the only other way around that, politically and organizationally in the Middle East and in Europe, is for the United States to be honest about this and say, well, Israel, you've got nuclear weapons. We're all in the same pool here. let us work out something where it's a universal settlement. Now, I don't think in the absence of that, that this is going to end well.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have held anti-Israel protests along the separation fence, calling for an end to the blockade imposed by the Zionist regime on the impoverished enclave, the Ruba Shavit reports.
Thousands of Palestinians were injured in a protest east of the city of Khan Yunis in the Gaza Strip, where Israeli army fired live bullets and tear gas on protesters who came calling for an end to the blockade imposed by Israel. The mass protest organized by Islamic and national forces comes as a part of the popular resistance activities that demands giving Palestinians their rights and allow the reconstruction of the Gaza Strip after the latest escalation.
Palestinians came here to stress the importance of the popular resistance with all means. They also demanded their human rights and called for an end to the blockade imposed for 15 years now. Palestinians are only calling for their rights to live with dignity. Israeli regime should be aware that the resistance will support its people and it will force the Israeli regime to accept the Palestinians' demands.
Palestinian factions warned the Israeli regime in a press conference during the rally that they won't accept any delay in the reconstruction process and ending of the crippling siege imposed for 15 years that provoked Palestinians' anger, stressing that the Israeli policies won't break the Palestinian willingness.
Israeli crimes against Palestinians have led them to come here to voice their anger. The Israeli regime must end the blockade and the Gaza Strip. Palestinians will keep to resist against the occupation regime.
Earlier, Palestinians held a similar protest where an Israeli soldier was critically injured and dozens of Palestinians were shot in clashes with the Israeli army. These protests held by Palestinians aim to expose the Israeli crimes amid the silence of the international community.
We call for an end to this suffocating blockade that has deteriorated our lives. This protest aims to find a way out of our misery. This condition is unacceptable. International community must give Israel a punishment for its crimes here.
Tensions along the separation fence are still ongoing as Palestinian protesters here came to express their refusal of the Israeli blockade and demand allowing the reconstruction of Gaza following an 11-day escalation. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
U.S. says the Taliban have pledged safe passage from Afghanistan for Americans after the withdrawal of U.S. troops at the end of August.
The Taliban have made public and private commitments to provide and permit safe passage for Americans, for third country nationals, and Afghans at risk going forward past August 31st. The United States, our allies and partners, and more than half of the world's countries, 114 in all, issued a statement making it clear to the Taliban that they have a responsibility to hold to that commitment and provide safe passage.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken said that Washington has evacuated at least 4,500 U.S. citizens and their families from Afghanistan since mid-August. He added some 1,500 other American citizens may still need to be evacuated from the country. Blinken noted there's no deadline to evacuate those who want to leave Afghanistan, and efforts will continue as long as it takes. August 31st is a deadline set for U.S. and other foreign troops, to leave Afghanistan. Turkey says it started pulling troops out of Afghanistan, but can keep running Kabul airport if needed. The Turkish Defense Ministry said in a statement that Turkish armed forces are returning to their homeland, adding they successfully fulfilled the tasks entrusted to them. Meanwhile, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's spokesman said Turkey may continue to run the Kabul airport after the withdrawal of its forces there. Earlier, Erdogan said that Ankara is still interested in playing a role in Afghanistan, keeping its lines of communication open with Taliban leaders. Turkey had more than 500 non-combat troops stationed in Afghanistan as part of NATO's now-abandoned mission in the war-torn country. Now, civil rights leaders in the U.S. state of New Jersey say police response to at least two incidents this year has been racially discriminatory. Activists pointed to last month's fatal shooting of an armed black Army veteran, Gulia Dale, in Newton. Dale was said to have been suffering from a post-traumatic stress disorder and was believed to have an episode on the 4th of July. The civil rights leaders compared the case with the arrest of a white man who shot and injured a police officer and fled in January. Activists said a state law enforcement exercised maximum restraint with regard to the white man and did not discharge their firearm. The U.S. Has been the scene of protests against police brutality and racism over the past few years. The Pan American Health Organization says unequal distribution of COVID vaccines is the main weak point in efforts to fight the disease in the Americas. Organization's director, Dr. Carissa Etienne, said that there are a handful of companies that produce the entire world's supply of COVID vaccines and make the decisions about the price and destination. She noted that much of today's vaccine supplies remain in the hands of wealthy nations. Etienne added, countries are also suffering because of production delays, leaving them waiting for doses purchased months back. PAHW director said only 23% of people in Latin America and the Caribbean are fully vaccinated, maintaining that hundreds of millions of others remain vulnerable. Last week, the Americas reported over 1.5 million new cases and nearly 20,000 deaths. The Italian government's plan to extend a COVID green pass requirements to all key workers and state employees is causing a stir. Many in Italy are not willing to get vaccinated and are against a mandatory anti-COVID green pass. Max Civilli has your details out of Rome.
The Italian government is considering further expanding its green pass scheme, which is part of a plan that aims to have 80% of its citizens vaccinated against the pandemic by the end of September. Despite a significant recent slowdown in the vaccination rate, about 60% of the population has received both doses of COVID-19 vaccine in Italy so far. The government is now considering making it a requirement for employees to show proof of vaccination, testing or recovery at workplaces, including public offices and supermarkets.
Mind you, the Sicily region, which has the lowest number of vaccinated people, could soon be classified as a high-risk red zone. The vast majority of those in intensive care units these days have not been vaccinated, and the Green Pass scheme serves the purpose of changing their mind.
Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi has repeatedly said that the use of the Green Pass scheme is the only alternative to a new lockdown. However, a conspicuous number of Italians are opposing the government's anti-COVID rules that they say infringe on their civil liberties.
Many in Italy are not willing to get vaccinated and are against the mandatory anti-COVID Green Pass. Earlier this month, protests were held in several Italian cities against the introduction of new measures requiring proof of vaccination.
L'essere umano è così, non siamo mai tutti.
That's how people are made. We cannot agree on everything, but the vaccine and the green pass is the way to go.
Basta queste scuse.
Enough with excuses. We are not kids. Maybe our authorities should be more severe with those who refuse to get vaccinated.
Since August 6, the Green Pass has been required in order to enter cultural and leisure venues across Italy. From September the 1st, the pass will also be a requirement for all teachers and other school staff. However, the National Association of Head Teachers warned on Wednesday that schools are not equipped to check all the students' vaccine passports. Max Civilli, Rome.
China has once again urged the U.S. to stop politicizing the issue of the origin of the coronavirus.
We once again urge the United States not to politicize the whole issue. I would say scapegoating China cannot whitewash the U.S. If the United States persists in hyping up the lab leak theory, then they should set an example and invite the WHO to investigate the Fort Detrick and the University of North Carolina.
A Officials said that Beijing will provide access to its labs if Washington does the same. Hu added that the U.S. has carried out more biomilitary activities than any other country in the world. His comments come as U.S. media reported that a classified report on the origins of COVID had yielded no definitive conclusions. President Joe Biden had commissioned the investigation 3 months ago, saying the U.S. intelligence agencies were unsure whether the virus was the result of a lab leak or transmitted to humans via animals. In January, a team of World Health Organization experts determined it highly unlikely that coronavirus was produced in a lab. Political commentator Mike Billington joined us earlier with his take on the story.
The early reports on the 90-day study of the origins of the virus that the Biden administration called for from their own intelligence community was released Monday in a classified version. There's supposed to be a declassified version, which hasn't come out yet, but sources are reporting that they came up with the same thing the WHO did. There's no solid evidence that this thing came out of the Wuhan virology lab, which is, obviously the case, and most of the world knows it. But I think you have to look at this with two thoughts in mind. One is that the U.S. has utterly failed to deal with the coronavirus, whereas China, using a zero-tolerance policy, mass testing, isolation and quarantine and so forth, has successfully prevented this from becoming a severe epidemic within China. Whereas when it hit the United States, we had spent the last 40 years taking down our health facilities with the privatization of health under the Nixon administration. And we had far too few hospitals, too few doctors and nurses, too few production capacity. And as a result, we've had an absolute disaster.
Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight. It is ridiculous for the United States to chase after its own vaccine skeptics without at the same time doing more to bring the benefits of this scientific achievement to the rest of the world. We now present you an article written by Jeffrey Frankel, a professor of Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. The piece is titled, G20 Must Prioritize Global COVID Action at October Meeting. Finance ministers, central bank governors, and political leaders are hard at work preparing for the 2021 G20 Heads of State and Government Summit in Rome, Italy, on 30th and 31st of October. With the COVID-19 pandemic stretching well into its second year, the meeting will come at a time of heightened uncertainty about public health and the global economy. And though the mechanisms of international cooperation have been weakened by the pandemic and remain bruised by Donald Trump's legacy, they are more important than ever. Cooperation need not refer to international coordination of national monetary or fiscal policies. For the most part, countries on their own can move those levers in whatever direction is best for them. Instead, the G20 should focus on financial stability, trade, and vaccination. This is in addition to other important areas, especially the existential issue of global climate change, which should and will receive a lot of attention. Over the course of 2020, most countries responded to the health crisis and economic recession with government spending. But emerging markets and developing economies, EMDEs, cannot finance deficits as easily as can Europe and the United States, with its exorbitant privilege conferred by the dollar's global dominance. Fortunately, many of these countries manage to meet the acute need for increased spending without having to pay sky-high interest rates. Owing to the aggressive monetary stimulus provided by the US Federal Reserve and other major central banks, the initial declines in emerging markets and developing economies, EMDEs, currencies, security prices and commodity prices in March of 2020 were reversed after the US Federal Reserve's easing. But now it is August of 2021, and every country must contend with a higher debt for GDP ratio. At some point, the US Federal Reserve will signal an end to monetary easing and a coming increase in interest rates. Whenever that happens, investors will pull out of risky assets and lose enthusiasm for the emerging markets and developing economies, EMDEs. Suddenly, EMDE debtors could face potential financial crises like those that struck in the 1980s and 1990s, or on a lesser scale, like the 2013 taper tantrum, when the US Federal Reserve triggered EMDE capital flight by suggesting that it will soon start to wind down its asset purchases. Accepting that there may be a bubble component to today's high prices for risky assets, the financial situation appears particularly fragile. Some say that soaring markets reflect economic fundamentals. For example, high price-to-earnings ratios in the United States stock market are said to be justified by the promise of digitalization and other productivity-enhancing technological innovations. But I would point to the surge in some financial innovations that do not enhance productivity. Think of the 6,000 old cryptocurrencies that have been created, and the rise of many stocks, special purpose acquisition companies and non-fungible tokens. In any case, the G20 can help to reduce the likelihood and severity of a potential emerging market debt crisis. The debt service suspension initiative that it created during the pandemic was a first step, but it only postponed repayment, and only for one class of international creditors, governments. It is widely recognized that provisions for possible debt restructuring should be extended to cases where the international creditors are private financial institutions, or where Chinese state-backed lenders are claiming to be private. A second step is the new allocation of special drawing rights agreed to by International Monetary Fund IMF members recently. Both initiatives come just in time for emerging markets and developing economies, EMDEs. Early on, it appeared that the impact of the pandemic would be more severe in advanced economies than in many EMDEs, with the exception of South America. But rich countries have since enjoyed unusually strong economic recoveries, aided by macroeconomic stimulus and the vaccines. Meanwhile, the other half has fallen behind. In its most recent global outlook for July of 2021, the International Monetary Fund predicted continued strong growth for advanced economies, but marked down its growth forecast for emerging markets and developing economies, EMDEs. Among developing countries, millions of people are being thrown back into extreme poverty. This economic divergence is particularly striking because it comes on the heels of a global convergence. On average, emerging markets and developing economies, EMDEs, had been growing substantially faster than advanced economies from the turn of the century until 2014, when Chinese growth started to slow and dollar prices for commodities fell. Among the many explanations for the catch-up period is that global trade increased roughly twice as fast as gross domestic product GDP during the decades preceding the 2008 global financial crisis. However, since 2009, the trend for the trade to GDP ratio has been flat. Unfashionable, as it is to say, the situation today calls for some old-fashioned trade liberalization. The United States and China should roll back the protectionist barriers that they raised over the last 4 years. One sector that is especially ripe for liberalization is trade in environmentally beneficial products, such as the equipment used to produce wind and solar power. G20 member states should work with the World Trade Organization, WTO, to establish new international rules guiding carbon border adjustment taxes so that they can be used but not abused. The G20 also should work with the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, to follow through on the exciting recent progress towards the global framework for corporate taxation. Most importantly, the United States and other rich countries must allocate more of their massive spending packages to make COVID-19 vaccines available to low- and middle-income countries. It is ridiculous for the United States to chase after its own vaccine skeptics without at the same time doing more to bring the benefits of this scientific achievement to the rest of the world. Ruchir Agarwal and Geeta Gopinath of the International Monetary Fund have proposed a plan of action to get more vaccines produced and distributed throughout the world. Even someone who is allergic to altruism should favor programs for vaccination in other parts of the world. So long as the coronavirus runs wild anywhere, it is a danger everywhere. The stakes of international interdependence are higher than ever.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady here from IRIB English Radio. Inshallah ta'ala, we are going to be having a series of discussions regarding the topic of women of Ashura. In the studio, as always, I have the pleasure and honor of having my lovely sister and friend and wonderful guest, Sister Razia Shamli. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, my dear sister. We are in the month of Muharram. Sister Zainab and I were having a great discussion about the personalities, the valuable lessons that we can learn from, especially because we are talking in the program of the Muslim Lady, we are especially zooming on the ladies, valuable lessons that we can learn from these. We were actually trying to bisect and analyze and try to get what we can learn from them in our life, in our everyday lives. Mm. We mentioned so many facts about Sayyidah Zainab Salamullah Alayha. We mentioned many paragraphs from the sermon that she delivered in the court of Yazid in the city of Sham. We talked about three distinguished qualities that she had, which was patience, being a servant of God, and being kind and feminine at the same time, and being brave, actually four qualities. And then in the midst of our talks, we mentioned other ladies like Dilham, Tawa, Maria. Here in this program, inshallah, Sister Zainab and I will be mentioning some other qualities of this heavenly ladies of Ashura and what they have for us to offer.
It's been a very interesting series of discussions, I find, and I hope that our listeners out there could find at least one point they could relate to, you know, one point they could connect with and hold on to and carry out in their lives. Because at the end of the day, perhaps that was the whole point of Imam Hussein's mission, you know, to capture the hearts with the blood that he had to shed and the sacrifices he had to make, and to be able to create a revolution, whether on a personal or a collective level in humanity. I've seen a lot of people that spent their many years of their lives in utter ignorance and rebellion against their Lord, but then something within them clicked in regard with Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and they found guidance. And that hadith that says Innal Hussein Misbah al-Huda wa Safinat al-Najat, he is the light of guidance, the beacon of guidance, and the ark of salvation. Asra wa awsa, he's the fastest and the vastest.
Wow,
ark.
So beautiful.
It is beautiful, right? Because it the thing about Imam al-Hussein's movement, it's that it captures every aspect of humanness, right? There's the spiritual, there's the emotional, the sentimental, the sadness, the joy, the romance, the valor.
Individual,
the
social,
yeah, exactly,
collective,
the
family.
Social, political, all, it's all there.
Life. Afterlife.
Exactly. It's so comprehensive. It's
right.
Such a perfect package.
That's why they say the school of Hussein.
Exactly.
Right.
And it set in motion such a huge legacy.
Right. Zainab, one of the personalities or feminine figures or ladies that I really treasure and I really like to honor, which was not directly involved in the day of Ashura, but had her role to play, was Salama. Salama was one of the wives of the Noble Prophet. After the demise of Lady Khadija, when Lady Fatima was still very young, the noble prophet entrusted her raising to Umm Salama, and she was like a mother to Fatima. And Umm Salama says that actually everybody thinks that I was a teacher to Fatima, but in fact Fatima was a teacher to me. It's so beautiful.
Yes.
And the way you see Umm Salama protecting and supporting not only Fatima as a personality, but as the path of Fatima, and also the path of wilaya or leadership, right? It's so superb and so beautiful. This is what the gem in Umm Salama's personality that highlights her so much, is this defending the wilaya. You know, after they usurped her right to Fadak, Lady Fatima had a sermon, and she tried to explain to them and tried to rebuke them for the ugly act that they had done. And Umm Salama was by her side, and the caliphs of her time deprived her of her livelihood for 1 year because she supported Fatima. This is, you know, she was an old woman at that time, you know? But she preferred to stay by justice and by the right, by the truth, than just, you know, having the little gain of this worldly life, and then to satisfy her immediate needs, temporary material needs, and then, you know, forget about the hereafter. And the other thing is that she was a narrator of hadith, and it's fabulous to know that she has narrated 387 hadith from the Prophet Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, from the Prophet's daughter Fatima salamullah alaiha, and also Abu Salama, her husband. And one of those hadith that she narrated from the Holy Prophet is that there's a beautiful hadith that says the imams, or the leaders after me, the Prophet says, are 12, the same as the number of the sons of Jacob, the 12 tribes of Israel. 9 of them are from the offspring of Hussein, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given my knowledge to them. So the narrator of this hadith has been Umm Salama. And it's interesting that she was actually one of the ladies, very wise ladies, that the Holy Prophet sometimes shared his thoughts, and, you know, she was like a counselor to the noble prophet. He trusted her wisdom.
Consoled in her.
Yeah. And her trust in her was to the extent that the noble prophet had told Umm Salama about the event of Ashura prior to its occurrence, and while he was still alive. And you know the story where she was given the sand of Karbala, and the Prophet told him that when this turns red, it means that my grandson Hussein has been martyred, and she actually witnessed this. And the moment, she was kilometers away from the land of Karbala in Medina, but when it turned red, she immediately knew that Hussein was martyred. And she actually asked the Prophet, because she loved the children of Fatima so much that, of course, she didn't want anything bad to happen to them. And when the Holy Prophet told her of Ashura and the story, she said, well, can't you do a prayer that Hussein would not get martyred?
Right, to prevent this.
Yeah. And then the Prophet said that, I actually received a revelation that this event, through the event of Ashura, he will receive such a rank in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that it is not comparable with anybody else. And that he, Hussein, will intercede for all his followers. And Mahdi is among his offspring. So he consoled her. I swear to Allah that his followers will be felicitous on the day of resurrection. And she dies at the age of 84. And you can see that she was a lady who always stood by the leader of her time, the true leader. When it was the Prophet, it was the Prophet. After that, when it was Ali alayhi salam, Ali. When it was Hassan, it was Hassan. When it was Hussein, it was Hussein.
We're going to go on a short break, and we're going to be right back, so don't go anywhere.
Thank you.
the studio with my darling sister Razia Shamili, and we're discussing Ashura'i women and Ashura'in women.
One of the qualities of ladies of Ashura is that they are wise people with open eyes, and they know exactly what's going on around them.
What we call basira.
Exactly. Insight, right? So she had that insight, and she was brave enough to support it, although there a lot of the times it turned on her back, and she was deprived of her material rights. So I see her as one of the ladies of Ashura.
Exactly. Very steadfast too, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just something that she picked up during the final years of her senior life. It's not something that she did while she was young and, you know, lively and spry. It was a life commitment for her that she carried out after Prophet's demise, when she protected and defended Sayyidah Fatima, Amir al-Mu'mineen, Hassanin alayhi salam, since their childhood till their martyrdom.
Constant on
exactly,
the path of wilayah.
Exactly. Her entire life is a journey in this path. And we could hope, pray to be so lucky, you know, so blessed to live this sort of lifestyle, to be able to commit and devote ourselves so much to wilayah and to the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Consistency, yeah.
Insight are other qualities of ladies of Ashura.
Exactly.
Whatever time it may be, even in our time. To know exactly the Yazid of our
time. It's very, very important. And I think one of the methods of obtaining that consistency in our lives regarding anything, especially the Ahlul Bayt in our religion, is to strive to collect more knowledge about it, you know? Because if we don't have knowledge and we haven't fortified our iman through knowledge, through ma'rifah, we will constantly move
back
to
and forth.
Yeah, exactly. We will constantly fluctuate. And like a little sapling that moves in the wind, you know, we're not sturdy enough. But once we are strengthened with a proper amount of knowledge, our iman is strengthened, then we can have that consistency and that steadfastness in our lives.
Exactly. And this is exactly what you can find in Surah An'am, verse number 122. Ashura's lessons and teachings were nothing different from the teachings of the Quran, right? And in Surah An'am, verse number 122, you read, أَوَمَنْ كَانَ مَيْتًا فَأَحْيَيْنَاهُ وَجَعَلْنَاهُ لَهُ نُورًا تَمْشِي بِهِ فِي الْأَرْضِ كَمَنْ مَثَلُهُ فِي الظُّلُمَاتِ لَيْسَ بِخَارِجٍ مِنْهَا كَذَلِكَ زُيِّنَ لِلْكَافِرِينَ مَا كَانُوا يَعْمَلُونَ, which means that is he who was lifeless, means who had no iman, then we gave him life, we gave him the iman, and provided him with a light by which he walks among the people. So this means that if you are after this material life, if the world is your aim, your goal, your final destination, then it's like you're a dead walking zombie.
Yeah.
SubhanAllah, it's like you have no faith, you have no soul, you have no life. And if you have faith, you have life, not only life, but a nuran tamshi bihi, right? A nur that you can walk with. And this nur is this guidance, this extra help that comes to you when you are uncertain which path to go, right?
Exactly.
So it's being, you know, piety is not so difficult. It's just servitude. I mean, at the end of the day, it's just like my case today, you know, this everyday things. You know, praying on its prime time, praying with the presence of heart, putting the right importance and the right priority to prayers. Mm-hmm. This is exactly what helps you to distinguish between wickedness
and wrong.
Deficiency.
Exactly. Thank you so very much, Sister Razia, and thank you to our listeners for being with us on this episode of Muslim Lady. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I know I'm waiting for something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges.
English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
Disruption to the global supply chains linked to the coronavirus pandemic and Brexit have also triggered shortages of raw materials in the United Kingdom. Economists are warned that sustained supply chain problems and staff shortages could push up inflation as companies seek to pass on higher production costs onto consumers. We'll prepare for you an article by Richard Partington, under the heading, UK's COVID recovery slows amid staff and material shortages. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Britain's economic recovery from lockdown has slowed sharply in the past month, despite the removal of most remaining pandemic restrictions, as businesses suffered the worst shortages of workers and materials in decades. The latest snapshot from IHS Market and the Chartered Institute of Procurement and Supply showed that growth in private sector output slowed to a six-month low in August. Problems with hiring workers and shortages of materials were 14 times higher than usual, and the worst since the survey of business activity began back in January of 1998. Separate figures from the Confederation of British Industry, CBI, showed British manufacturers suffering from the worst problems with stocks of components and raw materials in August since the business lobby group started tracking industrial production in April of 1977. UK officials claimed factory output remained resilient by historical standards in the 3 months to August, with activity driven by food, drinks and tobacco producers. However, weakness in car production, where manufacturers have struggled with global shortages of microchips, dragged on growth. Alpesh Palaya, the CBI's principal economist, said many firms were feeling the pinch from the supply chain distribution. Palaya said, despite the rebound in activity, ongoing disruptions could choke off future manufacturing growth. It's therefore vital that businesses and the government continue to work together to smooth over some of the frictions in supply chains and the wider sector until activity settles back down to normal levels. We'll be right back. sign that economic recovery from lockdown is losing momentum. The IHS Market and the Chartered Institute of Procurement and Supply Flash Purchasing Managers Index dropped to 55.3 in August from 59.2 in July. Any reading above 50 indicates expansion. It comes despite the easing of most remaining pandemic restrictions on 19th of July. Chris Williamson, the chief business economist at IHS Market, said raising coronavirus infections were deterring consumer spending, while businesses were struggling with acute supply shortages. Chris Williamson added the number of companies reporting that output had fallen due to staff or material shortages has risen far above anything ever seen previously in more than 20 years of survey history. He added, in manufacturing, sectors including automotive production and electrical goods have fallen into decline due to mainly supply constraints. Job vacancies across the United Kingdom have risen to record levels in recent months, while many firms have been forced to temporarily close or reduce production after staff were pinched by the NHS COVID app. Disruption to global supply chains linked to the pandemic and Brexit have also triggered shortages of raw materials in the United Kingdom. Economists have warned that sustained supply chain problems and staff shortages could push up inflation, as companies seek to pass on higher production costs onto consumers. The IHS Market Survey of 1,300 manufacturers and service sector companies, which is tracked by the Bank of England and the Treasury for early warning signs from the economy, showed employment rising at the fastest rate since the survey began. Firms responding to the survey said there was growing pressure to raise wages in the hunt for new recruits. There were also widespread reports that rising shipping costs and shortages of raw materials had led to intense price pressures. However, the rate of inflation for input costs eased to a four-month low in August, while factory gate prices rose at the slowest pace since May. Duncan Brock, a group director at CIPS, said the shortages were beginning to feed through into higher wages and increased shipping costs. He said an abnormally large slowdown in overall activity in August offers a stark warning to the UK economy that the accelerated levels of growth we've seen earlier this summer are not sustainable. Figures published earlier on Monday, 23rd of August, showed a similar picture in the Eurozone, although private sector activity managed to remain at stronger levels than in the United Kingdom, despite widespread supply chain delays. This pulled markets' flash composite PMI for the Eurozone down to 59.5 in August from a record high of 60.2 in July. Samuel Toombs, the chief UK economist at the consultancy Pantheon Macroeconomics, said UK goods export orders grew at a significant slower pace than in the Eurozone for the 8th consecutive month. He said, this highlights that Brexit has impeded the British economy's recovery. Private sector output in the US economy also slowed sharply in August, as supply constraints held back growth in the so-called world's biggest economy. The IHS Market Flash US Composite PMI fell to 55.4 in August from 55.9 in July, hitting an 8-month low. Meanwhile, according to official data, deaths from COVID-19 are now averaging 100 a day across the United Kingdom, and scientists have warned that case rates will jump again when millions of school pupils return to school next week. Figures released by Public Health England on Monday, 23rd of August, shows the 7-day average for deaths within 28 days of a positive test now stands at 100, a number that was last exceeded on 18th of March. Although the vaccination program means deaths are far below the peak of last winter, the highest daily total was 1,248, reported on 23rd of January. It is a notable rise from late May and early June, when they were consistently in single figures. Confirmed infection numbers have also started to rise once more following a dramatic fall in mid-July, with 31,914 cases reported on Monday, 23rd of August, the seven-day average figure having increased 13% from a week before. Hospitalizations have risen from 672 on 31st of July to 948 on 17th of August. Adding to the concern is the expectation of increased infection rates when students return to school and colleges across England, Northern Ireland and Wales, which mainly happens next week. Cases in Scotland, where most school pupils went back last week, have risen dramatically, going up from 799 on 2nd of August to 3,190 on Sunday, 22nd of August. While the return of school may have played a role in the rise, it is unlikely to be the only factor as they reopened so recently. Some scientists have warned that a likely increase in COVID-19 cases in autumn and winter, coupled with other viruses, could require the return of mitigation measures such as wearing face masks.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.